Good morning. Last week, we examined our hero identities, and for some of us, that was kind of an eye-opener again to come before the Lord and to ask God to reveal those things in our lives that we're hiding. It's like David, King David, in the book of Samuel. He was confronted by Nathan with those things in his life, and you and I are often, we find out, those people who think we're living hero lives, when in reality, we end up face to face with our own fallen realities. So if we're honest with ourselves, someone like the prophet Nathan, who we followed through the story last week, he could confront us like he confronted King David. Nathan could call out our brokenness and to say to any one of us, you are that person. You have fallen into sin. So this week, we're going to pick up where we left off and ask the question, so now, how do we live after we fall? How do we honor God if we have already sinned? It's a good question because we're all there. We're all like David. So let's go back to a key verse in the Bible from last week that says, heart-shattered lives, ready for love, don't for a moment escape God's attention. In other words, there's something about those lives that turn to God in complete humility that God notices, that God honors. So today I'm going to talk about how to live as a fallen hero. How do we honor God? So David has a lot to teach us about this. He was in that fallen state, and yet he continued to live for God. David knew that God honors a person who is humble, and he understood then what the apostle James wrote, and he taught Jesus' followers, saying, God opposes the proud, but shows favor to the humble. So we think about the verse this way. God brings the high, the proud, down low, and then God lifts the low, the humble, high. Do we get that? God takes the high and he brings them low, so the proud go down, and the humble, those who love God, the low, are raised high. The opposite of being humble is to be proud. You know, and sometimes as we think about these words, humility and pride, they're kind of common, but do we really understand what they mean? So, proud is this kind of idea of being arrogant, kind of haughty. I'm better than others, overconfident, self-important. It's all about me, right? That's the pride kind of thing. It's an attitude of believing that we are better than others somehow. We're just better. We're somehow cut out of better cloth. That's pride. Humility, on the other hand, being humble means to be modest, means to be lowly, it means to be respectful. I kind of like that term in there, that idea of respectful. And it all has everything to do with our attitude and perspective about ourselves. So real humility honors God. And David lived as a humble, fallen hero who honored God. So how did he do it? How did he live his life in a way that honored God, even though he had really, really messed up? So we look at him in the scriptures today, and we discover how you and I can also live in that place. And here's the tension, I think, that we struggle with when we do this, because if we have fallen and sinned, which we recognize, we say we have, the Bible says all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, so that's us. Aren't we hypocrites if we just kind of like all of a sudden say we're followers of Jesus? And yet, that's what we're supposed to do. So how do we do that? Well, first we start with three ways that to live as fallen heroes who honor God, and they're all centered around this idea of humility. And the first one is this. Humility recognizes that even heroes can fall. So early in his life, David was a very humble person. We kind of recognize that. He was low in his own eyes. So over and over, he demonstrates this deep humility before God. You know, we talked about how he fought Goliath. And when he did that, you know, he was never thinking that he's the one that's going to defeat this big giant, right? He always trusted that who was going to defeat the giant? God was going to do it. God was going to use him to defeat the giant, but it was definitely God who did it, and God was the one who gets the glory. So he's modest, he's lowly, he knows only God can do something this grand. And then he's, later on in his life, he's being chased around by King Saul. King Saul wants to murder him, and David has already been anointed king. And so he's running, he's fleeing, he's with his 400 soldiers, they're great fighters, and trying to get away from Saul's army who's chasing him down. And David goes into a cave in one particular episode in En Gedi. He's hiding in the back of this cave, and Saul, lo and behold, walks into the cave to relieve himself. And rather than killing him, David, rather than taking Saul's life and getting rid of this menace that's been chasing him, he doesn't. He's so close, he can cut a piece of his robe off, but he doesn't kill him. He lets him go. Why? Because he says he won't touch the Lord's anointed. He knows that he's not going to take this into his own hands. He's trusting that God is going to do it. It's complete humility again before God. Even though he could do this on his own, he won't. He trusts God. And then there's this strange story. Maybe you've gotten a chance to read it this past week in the Reading Bible of Kingdoms. It's the strange story of Nabal and Abigail. You know, David almost falls in his pride here. He has been out in the wilderness running from Saul. And while they're out there, there's this rich man's herds and flocks. His name is Nabal. And David and his men have really been kind of watching over these guys, these shepherds and these sheep over this time. And nothing bad has happened to Nabal's flocks because of David and his men. And so in great need at the time of harvest, David sends some men to Nabal and asks, you know, can you help us out? We have some needs. Can you share some of the harvest and some of the flock? And Nabal says, no, who are you? We're not going to do that. Doesn't seem fair, does it? And it gets David a little mad. You ever feel like that? Arr! And David's ready to go out and get his fighting men and destroy Nabal and all his servants, to wipe them out. He's mad. He thinks he deserves this. He's going to wipe him out. But instead, Abigail, Nabal's wife, she goes to David with some food and some cakes, and she pleads with him not to do this thing. In fact, she says, this would not be right for you to take vengeance upon Nabal. She said, leave it in God's hands. And David recognizes that God sent her, that God rescued David from falling into sin through this instance, and he says this: praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you today to meet me. May you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this day and from avenging myself with my own hands. Otherwise, as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has kept me from harming you, if you had not come quickly to meet me, not one male belonging to Nabal would have been left alive at daybreak. So David, thankfully, was low in his own eyes, which is good because God raises up the lowly, but he brings down the prideful. So last week we read that David fell in his pride. It's a shocking story, really, of a hero who completely destroys his life. And it resulted in adultery and cover-up and ended up in murder. And then the prophet Nathan comes to confront him. And he tells this story of a poor man and his little lamb. And David hears this story. And he hears how the poor man's lamb is taken by the rich man and killed and roasted for the rich man's feast. And the passage says, when David heard this, he was furious. As surely as the Lord lives, he vowed, any man who would do such a thing deserves to die. He must repay four lambs to the poor man for the one he stole and for having no pity. So David clearly saw the evil that was present in this story. He clearly understood that this was wrong. And yet he was blind to his own acts of sin and murder. David was ready to stand in judgment over sin of others, but he never saw his own sin. And David had become so blinded by his status, by his pride, that he began to take advantage of others without even recognizing that he sinned against them. He forgot that human heroes not focused on God fall. So we wonder, how can someone be that blind? But that's all of us, isn't it? Jesus mentioned something about that when he said, get that big log out of your eye so that you can see the speck in another's eye. We're quick to see what's wrong in other people's lives and slow to look in the mirror. Pride always takes our eyes off God. When we lose focus on God, we lose focus on what's holy and what's unholy. When pride sees ourselves as the heroes of our lives, then whatever our heart wants, our heart blindly justifies, whether it's a lamb or another person's wife or a life. Even the best human heroes fall into temptation. Even a man after God's own heart can fall into sin. So pride will always, always be opposed and exposed by God. So what do we do with that? Well, we can fight it, we can run away, we talked about last week, or we can do as David did, which is to fall before God in heart-shattered humility. The only way to honor God in a situation where we have already fallen is to ruthlessly destroy the pride that seeks to deny that we're somehow at fault, or at least that we're not as bad as others, that somehow God still ought to honor us and ought to, we deserve to be forgiven because of God somehow owes us for what we've done. But we know it doesn't work that way, does it? It is by grace you have been saved through faith, not by works, so that anyone can boast. Doesn't work that way. We have to rely on something different. We have to be willing to say, I'm guilty. It's me. And I need God's help. So David fell before God, saying, against you and you alone, God, have I sinned. So this humility honors God when we recognize that even heroes fall into temptation and sin. And secondly, humility honors God when it embraces mercy. Let me explain a miracle of mercy. When I was just getting my driver's license, I got this old car that I could damage if I needed to. And one day when I was out, it was time to get home, and in fact, I was a little bit late, and I got stuck in a snowbank, just barely. The tires were kind of bald, so it didn't have much traction, and it would just kind of sit and spin. You know, it was one of those old cars, you put it in reverse, and it automatically goes whether you're in the car or not. And I thought, oh, hey, I can get out, push the car out, and when it gains traction, I'll just jump back in, take off, and it'll be great, right? Good plan, right? And so I opened the car door, I put it in gear, the wheel starts spinning slowly, I get out in front of the car and give it a shove and get it rocking a little bit, and sure enough, it catches a little gravel and starts to take off, and what I didn't realize is that it would go a little faster than I thought, so I was running after the car with the car door open, and I just about got there, and it hit the other side of the road and hit a snowbank, and the door went, and bent all the way back. The car stopped. And I knew I couldn't hide that one. I was going to have to explain it. So fast forward a few years. I had learned my lesson. I was driving around doing chores and with my dad's pickup. And I had to drive through a gate. I opened the gate, drove in, and left the gate open, and went out, took some feed out of the pickup, dumped it into the troughs, loaded it back up. And I decided I was going to then back up out of the gate. So I had the door open and I was looking back, driving as I was backing up through the gate. I had it all lined up and everything was going good until I realized that it was a little narrow and the door flipped over backwards and bent all the way back again. I couldn't hide that one. So what do you do? Can't hide it. Can't do it over. Rely on mercy. That's what happened with David. David could not cover up his sins. Even if he didn't realize that he was doing it, when Nathan came along and pointed it out, he was guilty. He knew it. He knew that he was king. He could try to continue to cover it up, maybe even by killing the prophet Nathan if he wanted to, but it still wouldn't solve the problem because God would know. God knows. We can't hide from God. You and I need to know we can't hide our sin from God. So what options do we have? Well, we can't run from God. We can't hide from God. We can't get rid of God. We can't pretend that God doesn't exist anymore and he's not going to know, because we already know God is real. So we can only trust God. Trust that God opposes the proud but lifts up the humble, favors the humble. So we trust the miracle of mercy, that when we trust God to do what God says, then we can ask for forgiveness and mercy finds us. And here's what it feels like when mercy finds us. It feels like freedom. It feels like all the weight and all the guilt and all the shame are lifted off and we're set free. When I went home and told Dad, he wasn't really happy, but he said, it's fixable. And we went on. Mercy. David found that when he sought mercy, he received it. And he talked about it in Psalm 51. He said, "Have mercy on me, O God, because of your unfailing love, because of your great compassion, blot out the stain of my sins. You did not delight in sacrifice, or I would bring it. You did not take pleasure in burnt offerings. My sacrifice, O God, is a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, God will not despise." See, God brings the high, the proud, down low. But God lifts the low, those who are seeking mercy, and raises them high. Mercy is the only option for a fallen hero identity. As the psalmist says, heart-shattered lives, ready for love, don't for a moment escape God's notice. So there's one more step to humility that honors God. So far we've recognized that we admit that we are tempted and we can fall. Secondly, humility trusts in God's mercy. And finally, humility accepts the consequences. And this has two parts. It accepts the consequences of our sin, but it also accepts the consequence of grace. And the first part is really the most difficult to deal with, I think. It's the reality that we can't continue to justify ourselves. We can't make excuses. We have to accept that there's an outcome to sin. There are consequences to our actions. You know, a couple of years after crumpling my car door in the snowbank and then bending Dad's door off his pickup, previous to that, rolling his brand new pickup in the ditch a couple times, and then running my mom's 54 collector Chevy off the road and into the ditch, and then smashing my Mustang all up, I borrowed Mom's Chrysler New Yorker. She was pretty proud of her car. Not so proud of me by then. And I was in the middle of the winter. I started the car up. I let it run for a good long time so it was warm up. And when I went out there, the car was on fire. And it burned up. Now, not my fault, right? And my mom was extremely upset. I couldn't understand it. It's like, "Mom, your car burned up. What did I have to do with that?" She was really mad. She was pretty sure it was my fault. And, there was nothing I could say to convince her otherwise. And then I began to realize that, well, maybe if you take a look at my track record, there seems to be a pattern. There are consequences to the way I drive. Even if I thought it wasn't my fault. And that's just it, isn't it? There's consequences to the way we live our lives. And when we are disobedient to the way, God's way of living, there are consequences to that as well. So humility accepts those consequences of our sin. And this is really the heart-wrenching story of David and Bathsheba's little boy who dies. You know, the prophet speaks these words from God that David won't die for his sin, but the son born to them will die. And my first thought is, this is not fair. What's right about that? This baby is innocent. And the text doesn't make a clear case for this baby. You know, it's hard as it is, but in some way we have to accept that this is an ultimate consequence of this sin. You know, David's adultery and murder is going to claim yet another innocent victim, not just Uriah, but now this little child. And, you know, I want us to understand as I'm talking about this, if this is some kind of a situation that you have experienced, you know, the loss of a child, or you know someone who has lost a child, I don't want to think that we automatically make that leap to say, well, it must be their sin. Jesus showed that at one point that in a blind man, they asked, you know, who sinned? And Jesus said, neither their parents nor he sinned, but this was to display the glory of God. But in this case here, the case is being made clear that this is a consequence of God's sin, or of David's sin. And so David goes on his knees and he calls out for mercy. The baby gets sick and David is praying and fasting and trusting, you know, maybe the Lord will relent. Maybe the Lord will have mercy. You know, how many times have you and I been on our knees calling out for something, desperately hoping that the situation would change, and it doesn't? I don't think that's wrong. I think that's right. But at some point, we do have to accept the outcome. And so when the baby dies, David gets up and eats. And the people around him can't understand, why is he getting up? You know, shouldn't he be mourning now that the baby's dead? But David makes this, I think, this amazing leap to understand that he's now humbled to the point where he's completely trusting in God. That even though he can't change this situation, that there is life ahead. That he can trust God in the rest of his life. And he gets up and he begins to live that life. So humility trusts it into God's hands and lives forward in grace. But I have to say, if that was it, if that's all there was, this would be a difficult lesson, wouldn't it? It would be hard to have hope. I think it'd be impossible to have hope if that's all there was. But it's not all there is. There's a second part to accepting the consequence of our sin, and that is this: to accept the consequence of God's grace, of God's goodness. Remember, God favors the humble. Even though David had been proud, he now turns back to the Lord. He's now in a position to receive the consequence of grace. That heart-shattered lives, ready for love, don't for a moment escape God's notice. God notices. Jesus explained a similar understanding in a parable about a Pharisee and a tax collector in the book of Luke. He said, two men went to a temple to pray. One was a Pharisee, the other was a despised tax collector. Not just a tax collector, a despised one. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed this prayer: I thank you, God, that I am not a sinner like everyone else. For I don't cheat, I don't sin, I don't commit adultery. I'm certainly not like that tax collector. I fast twice a week, I give you a tenth of my income. But the tax collector stood at a distance and dared not even lift his eyes to heaven as he prayed. Instead, he beat his chest in sorrow, saying, oh God, be merciful to me, for I am a sinner. And here's what Jesus says about all this. I tell you, this sinner, not the Pharisee, returned home justified before God, right before God. For those who exalt themselves, lift themselves up, will be humbled, brought low, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. So God brings the high, the proud, down low. And God lifts the low, those who are seeking mercy high. David and Bathsheba had another son. They named him Solomon, which the name means God is his peace. So God has forgiven David, has redeemed the situation. David and Bathsheba are able to live forward in their brokenness. Although there was adultery, although there was betrayal, although there was mercy, although the consequences of that sin were drastic, David's humility allows him to be lifted back up. And Solomon becomes heir to the kingdom of David. And God gives him this beautiful new name called Jedidiah. God goes through the prophet Nathan and says, you should call this child Jedidiah, which means loved by the Lord. So what do we do when we have fallen? How do we live forward with grace? Well, we humble ourselves before God, and he will lift us up. We recognize that there's only room for one hero in our lives, and that is Jesus. We embrace God's offer for mercy through his Son. We accept the consequence of our sin and embrace the consequence of grace, of God's redeeming love. You know, my experience years ago when I encountered that conviction of the Holy Spirit saying, Tim, you are that man, it led me to a repentance and to a freeing, an experience that I never imagined possible. Honestly, I never could have imagined life like it is. Being redeemed. Cheryl said that moment, she has said that that moment has changed our lives. So there is life after the fall, and it's the life Jesus promised when he said, I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. Life all the more. Life beyond the brokenness. Alive in life, even greater than before. Life with confidence that the days ahead are going to be okay. They may even be good. In fact, we can trust that the days ahead will be good with Jesus when he returns. And that's called a life of hope. The prophet says, because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. For his compassions, his mercies never fail. They are new every morning. Great is his faithfulness. So God brings the high, the proud, down low. And when we humble ourselves before the Lord, he lifts us up high.